If you can lead people to believe that you are finding the patterns.
Have the power to predict?
No, I'm not saying that. Huh? I'm saying that if you can define the patterns of the present.
That exists, yes.
Establish the patterns for predicting the future.
Yeah.
Okay? We're doing.
We're doing this right now.
Well, you're not doing it simply enough for me, and I'm just suggesting that for the sale of the book, if you had used that phrase, poetry in the future, you say, that may be perk of my ear.
Yeah.
So what?
Unscholarly.
Unscholarly?
No, I wouldn't say. I wouldn't say. I wouldn't. I don't attribute any value to scholarship in the ordinary sense, and I have nothing against the poetry of the future.
That's a serpent child.
I wouldn't say anything about against the poetry of the future, except that the future of the future is the present, and always has been.
It's right here.
The future of the future is always present.
And the patterns of the future can be found now in analyzing the sensibilities of man currently, the way he uses his sense life.
But this is so obscure, opaque to most people, that it might as well be 1,000 years.
Well, I assume that's what you were doing, in a sense.
That's what we're doing. But Plato, for example, was unable to do this for his own time. And the people we're talking about regarded the discoveries they had made about, say, Gainsborough and that painting. This, to him, was a tremendous new discovery of new dimensions in space and sensibility. Every poet, every painter thinks of his world as one of a breakthrough into a new dimension. When you can foresee the dimensions that will be discovered, this presumably is what you'd call the poetry of the future. But they all the poetry of the future is already here if you pay attention to the modes, the new sensory modes.
That's why I'm asking if you couldn't delineate a little more specifically what you're saying.
Well, we're coming up to the 20th century eventually. We're just working.
I can do this through the very easy one, Marshall, of the color theorist, Ostwald. Because I think this was our initial breakthrough, actually, when we, or at least we verbalized it first, when Ostwald pointed out, he said, in color theory, it is as if you had a test tube full of color. And if you want to add anything to that, you have to take something out.
Or you will alter the entire mixture in any event.
That's right. But then what had happened was that we extrapolated this into the sense life to say, look, this is true of the sense life also.
Yes.
He said that no experience can be less than 100% experience. And if you begin to build up sight in the experience, then you've got to cut down sound. Something's got to go out, or tactility.
The there is a plenum or a certain limit to human sensory modes, and the diminution of any one exaggerates of some other.
So this is why the Western world, of course, has lost its sense of tactility.
Well, for example, if you live in a very noisy environment, your visual life is exceedingly diminished. It plays, heavens, it diminishes your powers of visual perception enormously. But it increases your powers of tactility, involvement. Oh, in a noisy world, people recover their powers of touch. They get with it.
You see, we have a quality in our society of thinking of order, for example. Visual order. Always visual order. I remember Marshall and I were sitting in Toronto one day, and we went and looked over your back fence, remember? I don't know if you remember this incident. We looked over your back fence and somebody dropped a Chesterfield down somewhere and somebody else had parked a truck and, dropped things. And I became aware then that this, too, was order. But it was a kinetic order. I mean, people...
It's an order of process. Yeah. An order in which people discard things.
That's right.
In other words, the litter on the street is actually an order.
That's right.
It's a kinetic order of people actually living and throwing and... expressing themselves, and they're creating a space by litter. It is not a mere failure to put things in their right places.
Because we have a tendency to look at this as a product. And if you look at it as a product in the sense of visual order, of course there is none.
Or if you think of space as a mere fixed container,
that's right.
Then everything that's in it must be kept in its proper place. But on the other hand, if you think of things as creating space, then you can't really have litter. You can only have an order that may be very undesirable.
But it's a humane order, really.
It's entirely human.
Yeah, sure.
Too human.
too human.
Burke said in this very century that we're looking at, the 18th, of Gray and Gainsborough, the first right of every man in civilized society is the right to be protected against the consequences of his own stupidity. Now, what he was saying was that the ordinary modes of human living and endeavor create nothing but chaos.
That's right.
And if you want order, you have first to start with the fact of human stupidity and greed and nonsense and put them in order.
Thinking of life, the living thing, I made the remark that the whole world would be better off if man ceased to exist. I mean, all the fish would fecundate the streams again, and the lakes would come alive again.
On the other hand, you say, Harley, the dimensions in which those fish and those creatures exist would be enormously impoverished. That is, human consciousness of them adds enormously to their existence. As witness the fact that in a zoo, the animals think of the keeper as an extension of themselves. They don't think of themselves as kept by a keeper. They think of him as an extension of their own bodies. This has recently occurred to Zoo U. There's a wonderful new institution where you turn tigers into hams at Zoo U.
What do you mean, turn tigers into hams?
Well, it's one of the functions of Zoo U. Well, they can turn tigers into hams, ham actors.
Oh, I see.
You see, you take a real wild, ungoverned thing like a tiger, and you turn it into a ham, a ham actor.
This is what they do with the porpoises of Marineland in California.
This is what the newspaper do when they speak about paragraphing. Paragraphing is the art of caressing a platitude until it becomes an epigraph.
Would you believe this all started when I asked you if you couldn't say headlines while you were doing this?
When I say that the future of the future is the present, I'd call that a headline, and it's an icon. And if you say the medium is the mass age or the massage, that's a headline. It's an icon.
That's how I was going to describe what I'm suggesting that you perhaps try to do. The medium is the message is a thing that fits easily in the headline.
It's a mess, age, hyphenate. Or if you say, the war is in words. The war is inwards. Words are inward. The war is inward. The real war, the litter war, is not outside there in the street. It's inside people. It's the people who feel the need to act that way. That the war is inside them. It's not out there. And so the war is inwards is another way of saying that within our verbal world, our verbal universe, we have created a mass of disorder, and transparency is an overlay, which is pure chaos. So the war is inwards. The war is in words. All my poems are on parole. Nice headline. Well, now let's cut.
Yeah.
And let's turn to another...
Constable.
Oh, yes. But that's Gray.
Oh, Gray, yeah.
Ode on a Distant Prospect of Eton College. Isn't that a beauty?
Yeah, this is Constable's View of Salisbury Cathedral.
That would go beautifully with the Ode on a Distant Prospect of Eton College,
right,
wouldn't it?
That's right. But one of the qualities of Constable, of course, was that he began one of the first plein air painters. He moved outside and thereby made quick sketches in which he broadened the whole field of painting, because he began to move towards the abstract quality of painting and away from a purely visual image.
Well, Tony, do you want to cut that sound before we do any talking?
Okay, I was just taking me on this, but this is the scene.
The constable world, you say, Harley, is really the discovery of the outer world as a world of artistic thrills.
Yeah, but it also begins to move into the whole world of paint, as opposed to paint as image.
I see. Not the nature boy approach of the Rousseauists and the early Wordsworth.
Oh, no. No, this is the beginning of Impressionism.
Yes. Well, Wordsworth has something like that in a poem, Upon Westminster Bridge. Earth has not anything to show more fair. Dull would he be of soul who could pass by a sight so touching in its majesty. This city now doth like a garment wear the beauty of the morning. Silent, bare, ships. Lie open unto the fields and to the sky, all bright and glittering in the smokeless air. Never did sun more beautifully steep in his first splendor valley, rock, or hill. Ne'er saw I, ne'er felt a calm so deep. The river glideth at its own sweet will. Dear God, the very houses seem asleep, and all that mighty heart is lying still. The use of an entire city as an art form for a single emotion is perhaps a little more than Constable was attempting in that Salisbury Cathedral picture.
Oh, I think so, yes.
But nevertheless, in Constable you have the same wedding of the art form and the nature form. The fields, the sky, all wedded to art form, artifact.
Yeah, and one intense feeling.
Of aspiration.
From one given tower. Point of view, yeah. Remember I designed the thing, Dear God, the very hoses seem asleep, while that mighty heart is lying still.
Yeah.
Because it struck me that those are the two lines in the poem, actually, which... Really,
well, they
brought together.
They focus, but up to that point, he is simply giving inventory of one item after another. Earth has not anything to show more fair. The city now doth like a garment wear the beauty of the morning, and then begins, that's the general setting, then begins the inventory of ships, towers, domes, theaters, temples lie open unto the fields. And this sudden interface, gap, nature-art gap, becomes an interface, a very exciting change.
Well, the same
change
thing happens in the Constable, actually, where because the point of coming together is that cathedral steeple, where all the trees mirror the steeple in a way, and yet...
The Romantics tended increasingly to eliminate the artifact, didn't they, in favor of the straight, natural, uncontaminated scene.
Well, I personally think, Marshall, you've done enough for a night.
Oh, I've what about doing that one with Byron?
Delacroix?
Delacroix and Byron.
We can try. Let's shoot a Delacroix.
Well, just a moment. We have Keats, Chapman's Homer, La Belle Dame's Homer, C. Byron's All for Love. She Walks in Beauty. Yeah, try Delacroix and She Walks in Beauty. But She Walks in Beauty is in the book. And the Delacroix is in the book. 177.
This is, of course, the invasion. This is the beginning of the invasion of the East into Western thought. The lion.
Well, that won't do for Byron so much as for Shelley, then. That's...
The horse, the Arab. Delacroix, if I remember rightly, had gone to North Africa and seen some of these, or at least had seen something of this kind of life. But it's interesting here, that... This demands a tremendous amount of visual sophistication. I'm quite sure that if you showed a thing like that to a primitive, he wouldn't know what it was. He wouldn't have the foggiest idea of what it was, because it's lost almost all its iconographic quality. The foreshortening of the horse, becomes an image that's extremely difficult to find, but it was first probably in Rubens. We found the same sort of
There's a tremendous kinesthetic involvement here, isn't there? It's like that wonderful movie of our time, The Dream of Wild Horses. The fury of savage onslaught and involvement. Are these horses that have mounted men on them?
Yeah, there's a man on top there running a sword into the lion, you see. He's mounted on the horse and throwing his saber into the lion. But talking about the Dream of the Wild Horses, this is where I made the discovery that slow motion produces the icon just as speed does. Remember I made this remark about the slow plunging horses and they became icons. They ceased to be...
Well, here you have the arrest of a very rapid motion indeed.
See, but the drawing is of such a kind that the action is implied. The next action of a horse is implied.
And the... what about the background there? The mountainous vertical scene of rugged rock and shrub.
Of course, it's purposely, the background there is purposely kept fairly flat because of the intense action that is occurring here.
It isn't really a background in the sense of it. No, there's no perspective. No. It's a flat.
You might refer, as a matter of fact, back to the layoff one.
Yes.
Grief sculpture, The tied up knots of the seasonal moment of intense action.
And you have the lion is one modality interfacing with horse, mounted, however, by a turbaned Moor who brings into play another culture, another mode.
It's an interface between a kind of a civilization and complete ferocity of the tiger, a lion, of nature. Of course, this is the romantic thing again.
Or again, is it an attempt to illustrate the furious passions of the Moor, of the tribal man, encountering the wild, untamed nature?
I think so. I think it's exemplified, too, when the romantic painters in England did the same thing, juxtaposed the quiet urban landscape against the industrial scene.
Well, strangely enough, what comes to mind here is the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam, juxtaposed against English and industrial civilized society.
That's right, I think it's the same thing.
You have an amazing similarity. I never thought of it till this moment, that we can easily illustrate from the opening of the Rubaiyat. Which has exactly that exotic quality of an alien world intruding into a Victorian order. It opens, awake exclamation, for morning in the bowl of night has flung the stone that puts the stars to flight. Violence. This is a dawn of violence, no gradual, graceful...
I remember a famous cartoon about this, as a matter of fact. It's the sergeant walking into the barracks in the early morning, and that's the caption of it, awake for morning.
And the next couplet, and lo, the hunter of the east has cocked the sultan's turret in a noose of light. Violence. That Delacroix painting is a perfect parallel here. The violence of nature and the scene under the mode of the hunter is exactly the quality that people seem to admire in the Rubaiyat, which challenged everything their will stood for. The jug of wine, the book of verse, and thou, wow. But this exotic passion for the invader, for the intruder, anything to shake the complacency off a world that had become completely visually ordered in the Victorian time, drove them back to the medieval world in the case of the Rossetti and the Pre-Raphaelites.
And drove Van Gogh and Gauguin and so on into the world of the East, the Japanese print. It's rather interesting, you know, that the artists first became aware of that because the Japanese used to ship tea wrapped in their prints, because their prints were so expendable.
Like newspapers.
Like newspapers.
And
this is where the artists of Paris became aware of these prints.
This poem of Fitzgerald is a perfect premonition of this Eastern invasion of the West. But
then later it became manifest in another way. You think of James McNeill Whistler and his mother, you know, the portrait of his mother, which is very quiet, very static, and moving back to the icon once more. See, which is Delacroix has no quality of the icon at all. It's just violent action. No stasis, no stasis.
Angra, on the other hand, pushes visual realism all the way to iconic intensity again by stressing the nude, stark, white outline. Dickens, too, in his strange way, by pushing realism all the way, and newspaper realism ends up in a new iconic world, like Hogarth. We really hadn't said anything about Blake in that connection. But Blake's violent reaction against the new visual realism of his day drove him into the iconic stress again, didn't it? Tiger, tiger, burning bright in the forests of the night. What immortal hand or eye dare frame thy fearful symmetry? It's terror.
That's right, terror and iconic.
Well, again, like that Delacroix image of the lion in violent throws. That Delacroix picture is very close to the tiger of Blake.
Well, it is, because it's pushing illustration to its ultimate limits.
And then how beautifully he contrasts it with the lamb. Mm-hmm. Little lamb. Mm-hmm. Who made thee? Did the same being make this terrifying image and the little lamb? Speaking of icon, in Wordsworth you get many great moments of iconic intensity, as a violet by a mossy stone, half hidden from the eye, his image of Lucy. When you contrast a simple little violet and a vast boulder, you have a wonderful way of bringing to life the iconic force again, each making its own space and the tactility creating the interval between them. A violet by a mossy stone, half hidden from the eye. One of the great moments of human perception. Haiku, too. Mm-hmm. Nothing greater in all Chinese or Japanese art, I think, than that moment.
I suppose what we're saying in a very broad sense, Marshall, is that the tendency of the human condition is to constantly try to return to total sensibility, so that the whole...
Synesthesia. All the senses at once.
All the senses at once. And so that today, our century, in as much as it is returning to this kind of synesthesia, is a return to the normal condition, away from what we have called a civilized state.
Well, the man, the hunter, has to use all his senses at once in order to survive. A computerized man, presumably, is back in that condition, having to use all his senses at once, since if he doesn't, somebody's going to bug them anyway.
But today, home is the hunter, home from the hill, and the sailor, home from the sea.
Yes, but what about that amazing, iconic instant, that little six-foot boat that came across the Atlantic with an airman as pilot? Well, a few days ago, they landed in Florida. After a 4,000-mile voyage, an airman, whose name I do not recall, who spent weeks sailing this six-foot boat across the Atlantic. This makes...
Did he lose his aircraft or something?
No. This makes Lindbergh look like a Pan Am passenger and makes Columbus look like a luxury cruise ship. So that we're returning, I mean, in this age that we're in, the desire for involvement and for the stretching of every human capacity to its limits is expressed in the most unexpected ways. I think of this little six-foot boat as one of the great moments in human history. It's so incredible that there's no way of classifying it. The press didn't know what to do with it. There was no convenient category into which you could put that sort of an... You see, it's the exact opposite of some vast blast-off toward the moon.
It's getting back to the primitive...
This is going back to the coracle. Some simple native paddling around the world in a coracle.
I'm trying to think of the name of the Norwegian who came drifted across from...
Leif Erikson?
No. I'm thinking of a modern man with the balsa raft.
Oh, the Kon-Tiki.
The Kon-Tiki, yeah.
And that, that was like the Ritz-Carlton Hotel.
I saw it, as a matter of fact, in Oslo, the raft. It was quite homey.
That's a great big place. They had a garage-like residence on it. And
that's right.
They had no doubt they cooked their food there and everything.
There was a motel on it.
Something like that. But by the way, at the opposite end of the little six-foot boat, you have the Queen Mary being turned into a motel in California. These transformations, metamorphoses of our time are occurring on all hands.
Right here in New York, there's a dormitory ship on the Hudson River.
Another extraordinary metamorphosis is the in advertising, they have huge skyscrapers iconically covered with printed words, tiny newsprint, instead of the usual apertures, wind fenestration, and such. Just huge obelisk skyscrapers covered with newsprint and acting as iconic forms to promote, of course, a Heinz soup or any kind of irrelevant object. But modern advertising art has become extremely iconic in order to involve the viewer.
Well, it has, in another sense they don't understand, inasmuch as the photography has become so remarkably highly defined.
Well, it has pushed itself right over the visual barrier into tactility.
That's right.
It's broken the visual barrier, like the sound barrier.
Of course, that happened in the 17th century, too.
When you say highly visual defined in advertising,
yeah.
You mean everything in sharp focus?
Everything. Yes.
Well, yeah.
Super realist.
Well, I think it's been going the other way.
That's right.
Way.
It's been going fuzzy now.
Yeah.
But Marshall says it's poked its way through that barrier. Mind you, in the 17th century, the little Dutch masters did much the same kind of thing when they began to paint the dewdrop on the grape, and, you know, high degree of visual.
Well, that is iconic, of course. Yeah. It's like the violet by the mossy stone. Mm-hmm. If you paint a single dewdrop on a single petal, you are creating spaces that are totally discontinuous. The drop and the mm-hmm. petal are quite unique.
Unrelated.
Totally unrelated.
Yeah.
In space. They're tactile. And Hero, The reluctant hero is the necessary, ideal, iconic form for TV imagery. The anti-hero. The heroic type will not do on TV. That's why they've got to have so many of these bad guy heroes, anti-heroes. The Peter Sellers, the Roger Moores, various kinds of Mannixes and so on, you know. They're anti-heroes, as they call them. But in politics, you've got to have people who wish to appear heroic in their willingness to assume superhuman tasks. At the same time, if they want... to survive. Kennedy managed to, I think, appear like the reluctant. He was heroic, but reluctantly, as if he'd rather be doing something else. Now, the best, the great master of this is Trudeau. Trudeau is probably the greatest TV image of this century, as you will discover slowly. The American press is not prepared to take Canada seriously enough to give him any coverage. But he has a tremendous mask. He could be an Indian, a Negro, anything. Yeah. But he's an immobile mask.
He's a canoeist.
Yes.
Not a communist.
That's the answer. They asked him, aren't you some sort of a communist? No. He says, I'm a canoeist. And he is. You know, but it's a wonderful wit there. You know, paddle your own canoe, extreme individualism, instead of communism.
You know, I was going around with something recently on tape, and it's such a perfect example of breaking the storyline. You know, if you say the line as a means of organizing communication...
narrative or something.
Yes, is out.
Yeah.
Then the line as a means of disorganizing it is in.
All right. That figures.
Yeah. You see, the St. Patrick's Day parade at one time used to be the thing that organized the whole city. Today it disorganized.
It's a line. A parade is by definition a lineal thing.
All right. Now, I had a piece of and it was very linear, telling you a story. You are now listening to this song from this record. Listen to this line.
Jim's album on RCA's Jerry Reed Carter to Save.
No, this is the disorganized one. Here's the organized one.
It's all from the birds, the bees, and the monkeys. Full Jim's album on RCA's Jerry Reed Carter to Save. And here's David Jones to talk about RCA's Jerry Reed Carter to Save.
Sounds when you're in your car, that you're in a recording studio with $100,000 worth of equipment. Yeah, great.
That's Zoo You.
Right, now, when I took this line that they had, we were listening to the birds, bees, and the monkeys from the Monkeys' new album on RCA, you know, the stereo tape. And I cut it apart, it became clear. I took the second line, put it first, and cut apart and put the talker in, put the introduction to the speaker after he spoke. And the whole thing became clear. Listen to this.
Cool Jim's album on RCA's Jerry Wade cartridge tape.
Yeah.
It's all from the birds, the bees, and the monkeys. And here's David Jones to talk.
It sounds when you're in your car, that you're in a recording studio with $100,000 worth of equipment.
Talk about RCA's Jerry Wade cartridge tape.
Yeah, great.
That's wonderful. Much better.
Yeah.
Oh, infinitely better.
So you get it. Comes out.
By the way, do you have today's New York Times? Page 30, look at page 38. if you have it handy, there's an iconic image there of a very unusual kind.
You have to put Daddy in the wings there, huh?
That's what I call service. Yeah. You got it?
Some people will drive 500 miles.
No, no, it's the pictures. It's nuns dressed in miniskirts with coifs. I know. Say it's so both ways. But I thought now speaking of the non storyline, I thought of the phrase for that, hey nonny nonny.
Yeah.
Get thee to a nonnery.
Yeah. And you know what a nunnery was at that time.
I'll get you to the Taj Mahal on time is a phrase, wonderful phrase from those Beyond the Fringe Boys. We'll get you to the Taj Mahal on time. Storyline time, you see. The Taj Mahal has nothing to do with being on time. It's timeless, you see. Remember that? I'll get you to the Taj Mahal on time. It's the Beyond the Fringe record.
Oh, yeah.
Now, you see, there's a perfect example.
Did you see this picture?
No, which was that?
The
one
last
time.
Let's see.
Oh, that's great.
Ah, luncheon in Subway Station.
6th Avenue INC.
That's great.
Fifth Avenue.
It's like John Wayne's story in Marshall.
Well, something that speaks louder than words would have to be eaten there. Oh, do you see 57th Street? Heinz. It's a bloody Heinz advertisement. 57 varieties. There they are eating away. 57 varieties of 57th Street.
Why doesn't Heinz buy all the space in that station?
Gosh, that's a Heinz ad. Boy, are they slip one over on. That's an old saying in the 20s again, you know. What is that? Nairdale? No, Heinz. Or... What is that cat a Manx cat? No, 215. The railway train, the 215, it cut off the tail.
Have you a brother? No, my
brother is an only child.
My mother was still the nicest.
those are all iconic. All those gags are icons. There's no connection, no rational relationship, whatever. They just create their own little space, their own little world, instantly. Joyce is full of them, where the hand of man never set foot.
You know what that is?
Thud and blunder.
You know where the hand of man has never set foot?
Where is that now?
The virgin forest is one in which the hand of man has never set foot.
I thought it was the Yellow Pages.
Now it's listening. There is no.
How do you like this one?
Because print is a patter killer, the word may flutter by.
Word may
flutter by. And the.
Because print is a patter killer, the word may flutter by.
Harley also afraid that he's the one who said, here he came in blowing both horns of his dilemma. Or let us take a little ride in our carsophagus.
Yeah. I was defining the new car as a carsophagus. You know?
These are little iconic juxtapositions, you know, of overlays.
They're playing Scrabble with words instead of letters.
Words are more fun, like Jung and easily frightened.
Young and easily frightened.
We were thinking the other day, we saw something describing Bob Dylan's music as apocalypse rock, and we thought, why not just call it Apocalypso?
Yeah, why not? Or you say Noah's archetypes. Why didn't Cleo get into the ark? She wasn't one of Noah's archetypes. Cleo, the muse of history.
Yeah.
Ah, well. Once you learn the technique, there's a technique of you just hop boundaries all the time. Keep hopping semantic boundaries back and forth, and you have a ball. But you also, every time you hop a boundary, you make a discovery. It's like saying they oped weaponly.
But you have to resolve something in the first one and the second.
Well, you can't help it. The legal loophole is a slip of the tongue, which my wife made the other day, but it's much better than legal loophole. The legal loophole is exactly what every lawyer is looking for. Let me at it.
I'm looking to find some bounty over the boundaries, but I can't get it to work.
You have to. It's just play. Consists in play. And literally, you start playing.
It's like I'm bored of education.
And would you take umbrage? No, I'd leave him at home. But they asked me, by the way, in the press conference the other day about the newsletter, isn't some of your thinking transcendental? And I said, yes, and most of it's incidental. And I didn't even know I was going to say it. Which is a hell of a lot better than transcendental.
Why do you think the press was so hostile to you?
I don't. Oh, well, that's a very good sign. I'm not...
shows you're in shape.
That's right. That's good PR. I never read anything about myself in the press, so I didn't know they're hostile. But naturally... Oh, well, you mean, personally, they were numb. That was about all they said to me, a question or two like that. You know, no discussion. Just numb.
What did they want from you?
Well, we're supposed to be gathered there to talk about the Dew Line, my newsletter. There's a nice little icon, by the way. McLuhan's Dew Line. Just an early warning system. But it is already an iconic umbrella built by the U.S. over Canada. And for American use. But to call a newsletter a Dew Line is like hanging out your washing on the old Dew Line. You want? Have you any dirty linen you'd like scrubbed? Well, we'll just hang it out on the old Dew Line.
I thought you said newsletter. That's your poem.
Because?
Because you're poetic in your references. I thought you had a newsletter.
Oh, newsletter. That's newsletter. Better. I never thought of it. Now, that's a slip of the tongue, which is...
Yeah, I find it very careful.
Oh, good. Only you can spell it M-E-W-S, and then you have a stable.
Oh, God.
It's like I
opened up a stable.
When constabulary duties to be done, a policeman's lot is not a happy one.
Well, I had a title tentatively on my book on museums, and I called it The Newseum.
All
right. Yes, we have no Bahamas.
Your remark when you got back from there.
No, I was while I was there, I nearly froze to death. So
any
How?
Any numbness complained?
Any numbness. Only numbness can play. You would have. It seems to me one would have to be deadly numb to play bridge.
Oh. Now you don't know how to hurt a bridge player.
Oh, you're a bridge man, man.
I'm a life master.
Oh. A black belt?
That's what my daughter is proudest of me for.
I wonder, we said we'd just sit here until they came.
Give them a call, I guess. I don't really stand.
Oh,
no.
It's just unfair to keep these people sitting
that's
around.
The point. That's why I said that's a.
Who wrote
Cousin Bet? I've heard about it, I'm not sure. 19th century. American.
American?
Mm-hmm. Oh, it could be French. Could.
She's asking you that because she wants to send it into the Sunday Times book section. There was a question last week, and she wants to sign her name with the answer.
I see. Cousin Bet. Of course, it's short for Elizabeth, isn't it? Bess, Liz, Betty, Bet. One unexpected nickname. Sheila is a nickname for Cecilia. I was told that once by a Sheila. Writing poems or what? prose?
No, this is prose. He's also written short stories and poetry, but his most famous work is his novels.
Well, now, writing novels in Brazil in the beginning of the century, this would be a very strange occupation. There'd be no reading public.
Well, he was, I think, one of the first ones to bring the form alive.
You'd have to create a public for yourself. Apparently, in Africa today, there are some Africans
who are literate, and therefore
they write. But there's neither press nor public. Think of the frustration of being an author in Nigeria today, or some other little...
Be a drum beater.
But the public just.
I think you were in China.
Well, I
stay here for reasons. This
way I can sort of
swivel.
Cover everybody.
Eric.
Should we name our church?
Well, church, you'd have to call it a church, wouldn't you, in these parts? And it pays you money and it takes your church. And
that's extending it a little bit.
You've done this. You've already paid for it. Well, obviously the new religion is the latest one. It's not out yet, so we. You have a little time to meditate. Good. Good heavens. What is the time?
After 11.
Oh, well, I imagine they didn't expect to get here before 11, so that means a little bit after. At least. Well... Well, Tony, what sort of in platitudes of the sort we're working on, what sort of people would you like to rally around to chat with? I mean,
advertising, I'd say a guy like Steve Frankfurt.
Uh-huh.
In music, possibly one type of person might be a Jimmy Jupiter.
Well, why don't you think about doing something like that for the Platitude series?
Right. Let me set up an interview with you and Steve Frank. He's a very young man in his 30s who's been supremely creative and...
I'd like to see some of his work.
Yes. Just made president of Young and Movable. He's the first art director to become president of one of the major agencies, which is a very interesting
thing. Yeah, I'd love to.
A non-word person taking over of a word-dominated industry.
By the way, I came across a good phrase. There's a book called Management in Machiavelli by Tony Jay. And there's one sentence in it that's worth the price of the book. Economy is not achieved by the actuary, but by the visionary. And he illustrates. The advantage of that book is that he has a lot of historical illustrations, from Bismarck to William the Conqueror to present day.
What type of time is best for you?
Oh, right away. Right. Oh, me, for Steve. I was thinking of these friends of ours, relatives of ours. Oh, for Steve? Well, just about any time in the next few weeks.
Steve, should we pay $1,000 or $5,000 or $10,000? You should really be sold to people
on an hourly basis. Just a moment then. We ought to think this out in advance.
Your father when you might.
The point about the platitudes is that they may be sold as bonuses for the newsletter.
Oh, quick.
Sit.
Hello? How are you doing?
Sure.
Are you about ready to leave? That really doesn't help. Wobble over to get that home and get on home. Because you will go on for another hour or two, right?
Bob,
it's after 11.
Bob, you will be
fine. Yeah, okay, we'll waffle home by ourselves.
Yeah, we'll go to Penn Station.
The way things are.
We'll get a cab.
No, cabs need to get right there from back here.
Well, dust them off,
Let me check with the get the consensus here, because we may be able to bed down on the floor for an hour and wait.
Would you want us to drive you all there?
We can. Is it a nice scene we can look at? How about going on over to their place?
I don't want it.
Some of the penthouse.
I know it. I've been there.
Okay.
I'll take you over.
Yeah. I'm not much inclined that way. I'd rather go home. We'll get over to Grand Central and go home.
Have a wonderful time, Miss Payne.
That's right. Okay.
I'll be pleased to be.